The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Members, we do have a quorum. If I could get a motion to approve the minutes of February 14th.
So moved.
The minutes have been moved. I guess I wasn't here. So, okay. Well, I assume they're all good. Any discussion on the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed? That motion prevails. Today we have a presentation of the budget by the Department of Corrections. You have two packets. One packet you should not use. So the one that just got handed out, I believe, with the blue is the one, the colored one. You should be using that to follow along. So, Commissioner, are you going to start the presentation out?
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, members, I'm still a little bit ill from last week. Both my ears are plugged, so if I'm not totally with it, I'll try. Representative Kelly.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Say, just a procedural question. I'm just curious. Do you know when you'll be fighting for a budget number here when we're looking at those numbers coming out?
When we'll be fighting for a budget.
Well, I know when you're negotiating your number for us.
I've already started fighting for it. Believe me, I think most people who've served on this committee over the years know that it's we basically try to build a bipartisan bill, and it's not that every other area is not a core function of government, but I think those of us who serve on public safety realize the implications of cuts to the Department of Corrections, cuts to the Department of Public Safety, so I'm going to be fighting for the highest number I can possibly get, and I've already had a meeting with leadership, and we'll continue to present our case. But we don't have targets at this point, as you know.
No, Mr. Chair, that wasn't the question. I've been around long enough and been fortunate enough to serve in this committee as you were originally chair, and then Chair Cornish, and now you again. And I know that is the feeling around this committee, that we're always, you know, we believe, of course, that we need to get the highest target. I was just curious from a date perspective. Do we have any idea when that will happen?
I really don't know. I can try to get some a better roadmap for you, though.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So, and also, members, if you have bills that you have that you want hearings on, make sure that you put in your if it needs a fiscal note, please put it in your request, because that's going to have an impact on as we formulate our omnibus bills. So, with that, Commissioner, we're ready.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. We are pleased to present our budget to you this morning, and I guess tomorrow as well. We're going to make an attempt to first frame our budget with this PowerPoint, and then we have other documents, of course, that will be provided to you, and I think have been provided to you, that you'll be able to drill down in some of these items. But we think this PowerPoint will give you a good overview. We've tried to attach a lot of numbers to it, and we think you're going to have a good feel for our budget when we're through with this presentation.
Commissioner, I'm just going to to outline the parameters for the discussion today. I hope you'll be okay with members asking questions as we go along here rather than going through the whole presentation.
Mr. Chair, I think that's very appropriate.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
This first slide is, we always start with our mission because we are mission-driven, of course, and sometimes corrections, when we promote offender change, which you can see in the first line, we don't necessarily connect that enough to reducing future victims. And I think we are always focused on reducing crime, recognizing that people are harmed less if we do our job well. Some of these slides are introductory and I think but are still important for us to recognize that our Constitution very prominently stresses the word protection, and we believe that our mission does protect the citizens of Minnesota. And of course, the context of our department, we are one of the few disciplines, I think, in government where we are very capable of identifying where we fall and where we rank, where our metrics fall in a national perspective. And since this is a budget presentation, I think the first is very important, that we are 49th lowest of all the states in our general fund expenditure on corrections activities at 2.7% of the state budget, and even less now, and the national average at 6.8%. Obviously, lots of that translates in because of personnel. We are very strong. A major expenditure of our department is on personnel, but we are, even knowing that, we are still 47th lowest in the country. And this is a new statistic that I don't think you folks have seen yet, and this is not necessarily related to corrections, but I think it speaks to the quality of Minnesota government and where our priorities are. And this notes that for every dollar Minnesota spends on higher education, we only spend 17 cents on corrections. And this is the best ratio in the country. Five states in this country of ours spend more on corrections than they do higher education. And I'm so pleased with this particular item that I thought it was important for you to see as well, because it reflects on the work that you folks do also.
Commissioner, can I just ask, because I know I probably ask this every time I see this slide, but isn't this a little deceptive if you couple in the amount of money that counties pay on corrections and on our total cost for probation, or is that all included in this number?
The first statistic is it is included, because the pass-through money does come through us, but the county contributions towards corrections are not in this statistic. You are correct.
So has anyone ever extrapolated those dollars if you were to look at it? I'm proud of the number too, don't get me wrong, but I just want it to be apples to apples when we look at this, because our county taxpayers are paying a lot for corrections also.
They are, but even with those, I have examined, and I will provide you with the details, but we've also examined, for instance, the number of community corrections facilities that lock up, workhouses, work release centers, and even with those in, we still fare very well.
Very good.
And this slide you folks have seen as well. It looks at the states with the population, the six states next in line demographically and the three below us. But clearly, you can see the difference in prison populations, and this low prison number certainly translates to low budget numbers as well. Sitting to my left is Lisa Ogrosky. She's Assistant Commissioner, and Lisa will take the next few introductory slides, and then we will move into presentations from our major divisions. And I think, again, that at the end of this PowerPoint, which will occur hopefully today, perhaps tomorrow, we will be able to present to you all the information you need to give our budget due consideration. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Lisa.
Commissioner, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This slide simply just shows the governor's budget, and we would just like to point out here that corrections is only 2.5% of the state general fund out of the public safety budget. This slide gives you a 10-year comparison, and we'd like to show you this information because I think we've been very efficient in how we have utilized our staff in the last 10 years. We've had a 48% increase in prison population and a 9% increase on offenders on probation. But our staffing have only increased 12% and our general fund budget only 26%. And we were able to do this because we've done a really good job at adding beds at our existing prisons. And we've also regionalized and centralized many of our functions throughout the agency. There's three divisions in the Department of Corrections: Correctional Institutions, which is our prisons, Community Services, Supervised Release, Probation, and Pass-Through, and Operation Support. This simply gives you a breakdown of those three divisions. 72%, of course, is the prisons, 23% Community Services, and just 5% for Op Support. We only have one change item this year, and that's for our employee compensation. It is a big number. It's $38 million. This only is for funding the compensation for current employees. Does not add any new employees, just current employees. If we didn't get this funding, it would equate to about 273 FTEs that we would probably have to eliminate if we did not get this funding. This dollar amount comes from the labor negotiated increases, 2% across the board, which is $9.5 million. Our employer paid health insurance increases, $11.1 million, which is into the next 2 years. Step increases, which about 65% of our staff are eligible, is $14 million. And FICA and other fringe is $3.4 million. This $38 million is assuming a 4% vacancy rate. This is not a vacancy rate that we are 100% comfortable with, but it does give us an opportunity to help the state with its budget implications and shortfall. Typically, we'd like to run at about 2%, but we are holding positions vacant for longer periods of time and trying to find any possible way to save money that we can. I think it's important to note with this $38 million that this does not include any across-the-board increases that may be negotiated into the next biennium. That 2% is only for the agreement that was already negotiated. This slide just gives you a breakout of our employee compensation and where all the money goes. 67% goes to salaries, 15% goes to health insurance, and then you have the small 1% of workers' comp, overtime, and premium pay. Premium is the shift differential for those who work late nights. There's FICA, our retirement contributions, and we pay retiree insurance for those employees under the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan who retire early.
Commissioner, can you go back to the slide on page 4 there? The 4% vacancy rate, is that across the board staffing? Are those correctional officers? Do you have that broken down anywhere?
Mr. Chair, the number changes every day. Significant amounts of it are in education. Some are in health services. We fill our security positions typically as quickly as we can, unless perhaps it's a supervisory position. We may hold those open. Correctional officer positions, we try to fill as quickly as we can. They're post jobs, so if someone isn't there, we have to hire overtime. But a majority probably are in health services and education.
And the budget, in our budget books, do we have this broken down more so we can see employees, the numbers of employees?
Mr. Chair, in your budget book, there is a page in the actual biennial budget documents that does give you FTEs by the three divisions. We have provided the committee with extra budget information, lots of detail.
And thank you, Commissioner.
And in there you will find there is some fiscal year 13 information, because we can break that down to a lower level than what is broken down in the biennial budget book. And in that document, you will find FTE breakdowns by each activity of the agency, so by prison, by the different areas in field services also.
To people, I don't know if you have your budget book. It's on page 5. And can this be broken down into even more specificity in terms of what type of employees we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, do you mean by, like, the number of correctional officers?
Right, exactly.
We have approximately about 2,200 correctional officers out of all of our FTEs.
Okay, please continue.
We have some pretty significant challenges when it comes to managing our budget. We do have 24/7 operations, and I bring that up because, as I mentioned about the post positions, you know, there are certain positions we have to have filled all the time, so we actually need to physically have a body there. We have very limited ability to control the offender population. In fact, we do not control intake whatsoever, and there is a very limited ability for us for early releases. There's a lack of alternative funding sources. Corrections is 95% general fund, which is very unusual in government. There are a lot of other agencies that have the ability to generate revenue or get a lot of federal funding. We also have the additional cost of the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan. Our contribution rate for that retirement plan is 12.1% versus 5% for general retirement plan. And approximately 70% of our employees participate in this, over 2,900. And we also pay that health insurance for those over 55. And if there aren't any questions on those few slides, I am going to turn it over to Deputy Commissioner Terry Carlson, who will talk more specifically about the Facilities Division.
Just before you do that, can you just explain, some time back there was a controversy over the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan. Has that all been resolved with the administration? And it seems to me that a few years ago there was Governor Pallente had some issues around the SERP.
Mr. Chair, there were some attempts to perhaps get rid of the Corrections Employee Retirement Plan. There have also been suggestions on how that might be changed. There has been some work done around negotiations about people having to serve at least 10 years in the plan before they get the full benefit. So that has helped us tremendously, so people couldn't just transfer into one of those jobs and retire after a year of being in service there. So there has been quite a bit of work done with the unions on that. And
so those changes were implemented.
Yes.
Okay, very good. Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just along the same lines, I'm just curious, from a negotiation standpoint, that is one of your most expensive benefits that you have, and certainly is not typical now throughout departments, even public or private. And so I'm just wondering what further negotiations we're doing. I mean, we're looking at even life expectancies, certainly a lot longer now. This is something that is kind of a dinosaur, is the way I would look at it from a benefit standpoint. I'm just wondering, are there other possible negotiation efforts that will help us in that regard? Thank you.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can take that one. The correctional plan, I think, reflects the nature of the work that these folks do and the intensity of the work that they do over a long period of time. And this package is similar to police firefighter packages. I can't speak to the exact nature of comparison, but the notion of stress and the percentage of contact that these individuals have with offenders really has driven this benefit. In terms of negotiations, there has been nothing presented in this last negotiation that would adjust that. We feel strongly that it, even though it is a cost driver for our agency, it does reflect the difficulty of the work that these individuals do.
Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, I can appreciate that, and I understand that that is an extremely stressful position, but it's not much different, I think, than that we look at for the state troopers. And recently they were asked to contribute more personally into their plan, which they negotiated. And so I think it's just an issue that we understand that it is a very difficult position, but you know, at these point in times, everybody's being asked to contribute individually along with their employer. So I would still urge you to that would be a possibility down the road from a negotiation standpoint. Thank you. That's all, Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to go back a little bit to step increases. You know, I guess overall this looks like a pretty good budget, but we have $14 million penciled in for step increases, and of course our pay increases are 9.5. Could you tell me a little bit about just how many people get step increases, what the percentages are, and the parameters for the step increases?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Right now, about 65% of our staff are eligible for step increases, which means according to their union contract and their compensation grid, they're not at the top of their range. Performance-based, so employees have to have a performance review that is satisfactory or above, or we withhold the step increase. Most of that is all negotiated through their union contracts, so until they get to the top of their range. The increases themselves range from about 2.3 to a little over 3%, again, depending on the union contract and the compensation level, but it's right about that.
Representative Uglum.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So am I to assume that virtually everyone would be getting those step increases on top of their 2% base?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, only 65% of our staff are eligible for that at this point.
Mr. Chair, but of that 65%, most of them are getting a step, huh?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's correct, unless they're not performing satisfactory.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to comment in light of Representative Kelly's comments. I understand the question about that, but I just have some concerns when we start going down that road. Some of these professions, like police officers and whether you're talking prison guards or whatever, the extraordinary level of physical toil that it takes on their body just has long-term impacts. And I would hope that if we start talking about that, that accordingly those topics are brought up in committee, and I understand that the need for cost savings, but I joined the infantry at the age of 36, the age at which most of the other infantry people that I knew in there had been in for 15 to 20 years, and they all looked a lot older than me, and they felt a lot older than me too. And similarly, when I talk with the cops on the beat and other folks, taking injuries as a regular part of your job has substantial impacts later on in life. So if we do start going down that road of toying around with retirement age for your employees, I hope that you can bring in commensurate impacts as to why we do have this age younger than in other professions. Not just for the health impacts they have at retirement, but also 10 years into retirement. That's all. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you want to respond to that, Commissioner Roy?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we will have some safety statistics, injury statistics that are later in the presentation that may shed some light on those comments.
So, Commissioner Roy, just to follow up on both of on that question, I mean, is the assumption, because all employees at the Department of Corrections qualify for that, or no, or is it just the correctional officers? So, or is it health care, is it education workers? I mean,
Mr.
Assistant
Chair,
Commissioner.
There are about 2,900 employees in our agency that qualify for the Corrections Employee Early Retirement Plan, you have to have 75% direct offender contact.
Okay.
And those jobs are all audited, and they're actually quality checked also to make sure that staff have that 75% contact.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you.
We will continue the presentation with an overview of our facilities division and Terry Carlson, Deputy Commissioner, who has been a long-term employee and a servant of the state, and she will take over on this portion of the presentation.
Deputy Commissioner Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the institutions division is our correctional facilities, and our primary function certainly is public safety, and that's through safe, secure incarceration, and also by providing research-based programming and treatment for the offenders so that they reduce their likelihood of reoffending when they're released. We want to change their behavior. We want to motivate them to understand what risks they have to recidivate and what programming will assist them in reducing that risk. So our corrections institution budget is the correctional facilities is the largest portion of the correctional institution's budget, and it represents 67% of the total budget for the institution's division. It includes security staff, maintenance and physical plant staff, and all costs for the food, food prep, utilities, fuel, supplies, and all those kinds of things. The health services portion of the correctional institution's budget is at 19%. And in just a few minutes, Nanette Larson is going to come forward and talk about health services in our agency. The institution support services portion of this budget includes corrections officer trainee wages, our retiree insurance, workers' compensation costs, our property risk insurance, and other items like that. And then we have relatively small budgets for our Office of Special Investigations, transportation, and workplace safety and education. So what we did in this next slide is look at our entire budget for the facilities, for the prisons, and divide that by eight, because there's eight adult correctional facilities, to give you kind of an average of what a facilities budget looks like by salaries and by non-salaries. So this slide really shows how staff intensive our facilities are. And a significant amount of that budget goes to security staff salaries in our facilities. The offender services portion that's right above the security section includes things like case management for the offenders, our religious services, offender personal support, like their, this is the non-salary support portion, clothing and supplies for the offenders while they're incarcerated. Also included is our transportation staff, living unit management. I think the rest are very self-explanatory. Our plant operations is about 14% of the facility's budget on average, and it's half staff and half non-salary costs. Food preparation, food is almost all non-salaries. We have a contract for our food preparation, and that's represented in that section. And then management services and support. A large chunk of that is in non-salaries, and that is for general staff support for our phone systems, for postage, computers, office supplies, safety initiatives, and those types of things. And then offender compensation is 2% non-salaries, and that's for compensating offenders for the work that they do in our facilities. This next slide just shows where all of our facilities are located. As I said earlier, we have eight adult prisons and two juvenile facilities. The two juvenile facilities, one at Red Wing and one at Togo. We have about 9,500 adult offenders in our system. This is dated as of July of this past year. and about 150 juvenile offenders. Go on to the next one. This slide just shows you that the people who are incarcerated in our facilities are broken down into 50% person offenders, and the next largest category is 17% as drug offenders. You'll see over on the left of this slide that on average, drug offenders have about 3.2 prior felony convictions. So people are generally not coming to prison without some prior felony convictions. 95% of our population is going to be released back into the community, and for this population, most offenders serve two-thirds of their sentence in prison and then one-third on community supervision. So I'm going to take a little bit of time and talk about safety in our facilities and in the field. Safety is so important in the work that we do because we work in dangerous environments, and we want to focus on making sure that our staff can reduce their risk for injury. Back about a year ago, we hosted a safety summit with our Community Corrections Act county partners and our county probation officer partners to look at enhancing and focusing on safety for probation and parole supervised release. We looked and talked a lot about training for these agents for home visits, to make them more safe for equipment that they may need to have while they're conducting home visits. We looked at and talked about office layout and ways to be safer in an office setting when, you know, we have violent, volatile offenders coming in for those office visits. We also talked about other kinds of safety equipment, such as lone worker alarms, which agents can have on them, and if they don't report within a certain amount of time, an alarm will go off and we'll be checking on them. So there's all kinds of things that we really focused on community services and safety in the field during that safety summit. A couple of other things that have happened. As a result, we devised a Community Services Safety Advisory Committee that meets on a very regular basis and continues to work on the initiatives that were developed from the Safety Summit. Within the Facilities Division, we have, a healthy competition amongst the facilities to compete for a Safety Excellence Award. And we look at a variety of factors for that award, and every quarter we keep track of these things. We look at the number of OSHA recordables that happen at that facility. We look at the number of lost time days that employees have. We look at weekly inspections and the percentage that are completed or the percentage that aren't completed, because we know that if staff, supervisors, and managers are out inspecting facilities and looking at how things are going within those facilities, they will tend to be safer places. And then we also pay attention to work orders that staff put in for things that need repair or replacement and are safety related, and try to get those taken care of in a more expedient manner. We just recognized staff at our Willow River facility for having, at that time it was 1,372 days without a work-related injury that resulted in a lost time from work. That's almost 4 years. It's just a phenomenal tribute to the importance they place on safety at that facility. So safety, promoting a safety culture, is very, very important in our facilities, and I'm going to be getting to now some comparisons for workers' comp incident rates. And this is a chart that compares our agency with several other agencies. And you can see that our rate of incident in 2007 was 6. And as of 2011, we have decreased to 4.6%. We are participating in the governor's MinSafe initiative to reduce workers' compensation claims by 25% from fiscal year 11 until fiscal year 14. And for us, what we need to get to in fiscal year 14 to meet this rate is to be at an incident rate of 3.44. So you can see, as of 2011, we were at 4.6. We have a ways to go, but I think that you know, we're on the right track. And as we compare ourselves to other agencies, I think that overall we're doing well with our safety initiatives. We showed this slide at a previous presentation, and it just shows the number of felony level assaults on staff is decreasing over the years. And we attribute this to enhanced safety culture in our training for staff who need to de-escalate and deal with volatile offenders, to de-escalate and not have to use force, and thereby reducing their risk for injury. This is only felony level assaults on staff with, you know, there has to be demonstrable bodily harm. It doesn't represent all assaults on staff, and I'll be getting to that in just a few minutes with our workers' comp data. Okay, this next slide talks about workers' compensation costs by fiscal year. And you will see in fiscal year 12, we paid $3.6 million in workers' comp costs. Many of these costs are for injuries that occurred in previous years, however. So while you've seen the incident rate decrease, it seems counterintuitive that the cost of workers' comp would increase. However, there are a few things that attribute to that. We have a staff person who works very closely with employees and also with our Department of Administration workers' comp staff to return people to work, to resolve claims, to if someone needs to not come back to work, to try to close those claims. And so we've been very aggressive with processing those, and that will attribute to the higher cost. Also, higher cost for health care is a portion of the rationale for the increased costs. All right, this is a five-year snapshot.
Excuse me one second, Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair, and ma'am, this isn't a huge deal, but you had mentioned the felony level assaults. You said demonstrable body harm. Is there a lower level for corrections? Because usually it's substantial or great bodily harm. I just wondered if there was a...
Mr. Chair, Representative Cornish, I believe I misspoke. It's the same standard.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. This is a five-year snapshot of injuries by all employees within our Department of Corrections. You will see slips, trips, and falls are our most frequent injury. Overexertion is about repetitive motion injuries or musculoskeletal injuries. It's non-impact kinds of things, lifting, pulling, pushing, those kinds of things. The struck by or struck against is about when somebody maybe runs into something and gets struck by a door or a desk or those kinds of things. Assault is a contact with an offender, or if a visitor or someone else would be engaged in a fight or some kind of contact with a staff member. And then the bodily reaction, no contact, is things like someone's legs gave out from underneath them, and it wasn't related to a slip or a trip, but it was, you know, no contact with something else, like a struck by or against. I'm going to put this in context of fiscal 12 now so that you can get just a little picture for how many, and it's not demonstrated in a slide. I'm just going to tell you some numbers. So for fiscal year 12, for all staff, we had 36 staff who slipped, tripped, or fell, and six of those were corrections officers. Overexertion for fiscal 12, it was 62 staff, and 24 of those were corrections officers. In the struck by or against category, 34. for all staff, and 10 of those were for corrections officers. And the assault, 24 staff total, and corrections officers, 17 of the 24 were corrections officers. The bodily reaction, 23 staff in fiscal 12 had that injury. Again, this is 5 years worth of data, and it just shows that corrections officers have the most significant number of injuries, work-related injuries.
Deputy Commissioner, why don't you have slides that give us more of a year by year, this is going up or down, rather than just an over a 4 year period.
We certainly could provide that for you. It's just how we formulate.
The only reason I asked that is I remember when this committee years ago went through a laborious process over whether we should be double bunking in all of our institutions, and it was controversial at Stillwater. And then there was, back then, we were able to see a spike in correctional officer injuries because of that policy implication. So sometimes when we see spikes or declines, it's helpful to the committee.
Mr. Chair, we certainly could provide that information to you. Also, if you go back to the chart that compares us with other state agencies, that gives an overall incident rate that shows the decrease. But by the specific categories, we certainly could.
Just for the future. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With regard to all these, the injuries and things, do you have any statistics in terms of your days lost of work for 12 here with the 36 falls and the overexertions and things? How many days lost total work?
Deputy Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do have that data. I don't have it here with me today, but we certainly can provide that lost time.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think that when you're talking injuries like this, a natural for the next slide would be the total number of days lost, because obviously that's a cost.
Yes, it is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Cornish.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Carlson, it looks like you didn't miss both. I was... we looked at the statute here at fourth degree assault as a felony on a correctional officer, so you were right the first time. So. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you. I stand corrected
twice.
the correctional, we had a little, I guess there is a separate exception for a correctional employee. So a fourth degree assault felony would qualify as a felony for the graph there. So I was thinking it was the same. It had to be great bodily harm or whatever, but it didn't. So thank you.
Please continue.
All right. I'm now going to ask Annette Larson to come forward and talk about health services.
Thank you.
Ms. Larson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's nice to be here. I'm going to spend a little bit of time sharing information with you about our correctional health care system and how we provide health care to our offender population. Most of you know, but some of you may not, that offenders have a right to health care under the Eighth Amendment prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment. We cannot be deliberately indifferent to their needs, so we can't just ignore what their concerns are. However, that deliberate indifference does not require us to provide an optimal level of care, but we do have to provide a level of care that conforms to community standards. This is our health services budget. In Minnesota, the health services budget includes medical, dental, nursing, mental health services, chemical dependency treatment, and sex offender treatment. So really, six different disciplines. Of course, a majority of the budget goes to salaries for state employees. There's about 480 state employees who provide health care, and they include RNs, LPNs, dentists, dental assistants, medical records staff, and other support staff. Mental health professionals, both licensed and unlicensed, and then, of course, our sex offender and chemical dependency treatment staff, and they can be all very ranges. A good portion, 41% of our budget, goes to our contracted medical services, which is our contract with Corizon. They used to be called Correctional Medical Services, but they merged with an entity called PHS, and now they are called Corizon. We are in the 15th year of a relationship with Corizon. Back in the late 1990s, we decided to start purchasing health care a little bit smarter and a little bit wiser. I think Assistant Commissioner Ogrosky mentioned that we've centralized a lot of functions, and one of those functions was health care. Each institution used to purchase health care on its own, which was kind of a heyday for the offenders. They would play one physician against the other. We didn't have any kind of formulary. There were no managed care principles at all in our system. So about 15 years ago, we privatized, and now we are working with Corizon. And they have done a tremendous help for us in terms of implementing managed care into our system. Our contract with them expires 12/31 of 13, so this year, and we are in the process of developing an RFP for the next go round. Our contract with Corizon is responsible for all of our on-site primary care providers, so that includes both physicians and mid-level practitioners. All of our on-site psychiatry, our ancillary services, prescription drugs. They contract on our behalf with specialists in the community as well as for inpatient and outpatient hospital services. They do all of our utilization review and then, of course, claims adjudication. One of the fascinating aspects of correctional health care is that we don't get to choose who comes to us. We have to take whoever the courts send to us. So that may be, you know, a very healthy 35-year-old, or it may be a 55-year-old who is on Humira for rheumatoid arthritis. For those of you who don't know, Humira is about $1,300 a month. We don't get to choose who comes to us. We've got to take who comes to us. Most of our offenders rarely access primary care before they come to the department. They participate in high-risk behaviors, so they're not in really very good health. As I said, we provide medical, dental, and mental health care to the offenders. With respect to mental health care, we use licensed and unlicensed mental health professionals. The offenders can access mental health services just by asking, or they can be referred by our security staff or any other staff for that matter. We have an on-call psychologist 24/7 who provides services to the entire system. Of course, all of our offenders are assessed at intake for any mental health concerns that they might have. If we spot something at intake, we will try and get them to see a psychiatrist within the next 14 days or so. 14 days or so. And I'll talk a little bit more about some other mental health services that we have in a couple of slides. As far as dental services are concerned, we have teams of dentists and dental assistants, and they kind of travel from institution to institution. They primarily focus on emergent or urgent care, such as pain, swelling, bleeding. If they do have time, they'll try and provide routine services, such as cleanings or filling of cavities. Again, our offenders are all screened for dental needs upon intake. With respect to medical nursing care, we have ambulatory clinics, and it's pretty much like what you or I would go to, except you don't have to fill out a kite. You can just call and make an appointment. But the kites are triaged by our nursing staff, and our clinics are actually managed by a team of nurses and our physicians. Most sites have primary care providers on site at least 4 days a week. Some have primary care providers there 5 days a week. And again, we run them just like a clinic that you or I would go to. Our nurses have standing orders, so they can deal with some issues without the offender having to see the practitioner, or if the situation warrants, they can send them right on to the doc. We do have a copay for offender-initiated requests. It's a $5 copay. One of the good things about our system is that we have a blended system of state employees and then this contractor, and that actually provides a very natural check and balance for quality in our system. We have some pretty good capacity in our system for being as small as we are. We have a 54-bed transitional care unit at our facility at Oak Park Heights, which is our maximum custody facility. And it's really for those acute medical needs. So pre- and post-surgical issues, we can provide IV therapy there. So if you need hydration or if you need IV antibiotics, we do wound care there. We also have a hospice program. We have, well, last year we had about 20 offenders die in our custody. Most of them are dying of natural causes. Cancer and liver issues are predominantly highest causes of death. And so we do have a hospice program of which we're very proud. Our transitional care unit has 24-hour nursing as well. It's one of two sites that has 24-hour nursing. Our other site that has 24-hour nursing is our Linden unit, which is the 84-bed geriatric unit at Faribault. The mental health unit at Oak Park Heights also is a residential mental health unit. It's not really considered inpatient, but it's residential in nature. And that facility helps us manage those offenders who have acute psychoses or episodes of acute psychoses, those who might need some medication management, those who are chronically mentally ill and who maybe are never going to see general population. And we also use it for consultations. Shakopee, our female facility, doesn't have a residential mental health unit like this. They have an outpatient mental health unit. So if we need a higher level of care for our female population, we might use St. Peter, the DHS facility, or we might look to the community for some help there. We have an 8-bed dialysis unit at Oak Park Heights. I tell you, that unit has saved this state hundreds of thousands of dollars. Every time we take an offender offsite for medical care, they are transported by two officers. So imagine one offender who needs dialysis three times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, sitting in a chair for 4 to 5 hours, and two officers are sitting there with them. So our 8-bed dialysis unit has really saved this state tremendous amounts of money. We also do nephrology clinics. So we have a physician who comes on site to Oak Park Heights and manages the care of all of our offenders who are in dialysis as well as pre-dialysis. Then we have our 8-bed geriatric unit at Faribault, which we call our Linden unit. That unit serves our quadriplegics and paraplegics who are able to do some of their activities of daily living on their own but need a little bit closer monitoring. It's also for our elderly population who has, you know, some of the old people's diseases, coronary artery disease or COPD or dementia. We do have 24-hour nursing at that facility as well. As I mentioned earlier, we don't get to choose who comes to us. And just like the community population, our population is aging. And I'm not going to read the statistics. You can see here how our population has aged, and our over 65 population has really grown over the past number of years. Of course, with an aging population comes a much more acute healthcare need. Our HIV-positive population, of course, is growing as well. That may have something to do with
Ms. the... Ms. Larson, yes. Can I just interrupt you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
A bunch of questions here.
Sure.
Representative Ward is first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Larson, I heard you say once that there was 24-hour nursing care somewhere. I don't remember which site, but let's say a prisoner has an emergency in the evening or after hours or something, do you have an emergency facility or do you take them to the local emergency room?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ward, a couple of things. We have two facilities who have 24-hour nursing. One is Oak Park Heights and then the other is Faribault. The rest of our facilities do not. But all of our officer staff are trained as EMTs. So they are all trained as first responders. So they all have basic first aid skills. We also have access to an on-call physician 24/7. And we've prepared a form for our officer staff that helps them convey information, clinical information, to the practitioner that's on call. But our officers all know that if they see an emergency, they can call 911 and have an ambulance take an offender to an emergency room at any given time.
Thank you.
Can I follow up on that? Because it's either last year or the year before. It seems to me that the unions at some of the prisons were concerned about safety considerations when they had to transport offenders to medical clinics outside of the facilities. Is that not an issue? I don't know if anyone from AFSCME is here or if that's even fair to ask them the question, but probably not fair right now. But I know that was an issue, and it sounds like from your testimony it's not. But
Mr. Chair, a couple of thoughts on that. We try to have all of our offenders seen for kind of those specialty clinics at a clinic that has been specially designed for us at St. Joe's. So to the extent that they can accommodate us with the various specialties, and that clinic is very secure. It's generally used only for corrections. It's got all sorts of lockdowns, and I mean, so it's very secure. But we don't always get to have our offenders seen at that clinic. There might be a specialist, neurology, for example. We generally use the Naran Clinic, and they won't go to St. Joe's. So we have to use community clinics for our offenders.
I guess the question is: are the facilities short-staffed if you have emergencies where you're taking where it takes probably two correctional officers to accompany the offender to a clinic? I mean, if we don't have the answers now, I do know that this was a staff concern at one point, and I don't know if it's been rectified. So if you don't have the answers now, I'd rather we get them later.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that.
Okay.
There are occasions, especially in the middle of the night, if there is an emergency and staff have to accompany offender off-ground for an ambulance trip, that facility would reduce the amount of staff that it has, and it could create some hardships. We do plan, however, for that. You know, if there's emergencies, a couple that happen kind of simultaneously, and that has happened in our facilities, the staffing levels go even lower, and it can be problematic.
But if I might add, Mr.
Ms. Larson,
we do have a central medical transportation unit whose purpose is to help the facilities with transporting offenders to their appointments. But those would be the planned ones.
Okay. So maybe you can draft a little memo just on the status of all this, because I think it's a little more complicated than we're talking about here, and I didn't want to put you on the spot or the union on the spot, but and I don't know if you folks are at some point willing to come up and talk to the committee, too, about any concerns you have, not today, but at another point. Anyway, so Representative Mullery, I think, was next, and then Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned the quadriplegics, and I remember being down at that time. It was at Faribault, and I don't know if it's still there. But we had staff even having to feed them. How much do they cost us? Are they really that dangerous that we couldn't parole them or something? It's the general question.
Ms. Larson?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mullery, we don't break down costs by a certain type of condition versus another, because most of the care for that quadriplegic is going to be provided on site. So it would just be encompassed in our day-to-day operations. I certainly can get you costs of off-site care for a quadriplegic or somebody who's got brain cancer, those kinds of things, because we would generate claims for that off-site. But we don't generate claims for that. I can tell you that we do have a conditional medical release policy that allows the commissioner to release somebody to the community who does not pose a public safety threat and who has access to care on the outside that we can't give them. So, for example, we can't provide ventilator-dependent care. But somebody like a quadriplegic would be a good person that we would look at to release on a conditional medical release.
Representative Mullery.
No.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director, going back to the Corizon contract, you mentioned that you'll be going out for an RFP in 2013. My question is, how many players are in the marketplace that we can expect, and what type of competitive bidding are we going to get?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Uglum, given that Corizon or CMS merged with right. PHS, we have one less. But I have been in contact with, I want to say, four, maybe five other companies who are very interested in our business. You know, I wish I could tell you that there were 20 companies out there who were interested in submitting an RFP for us, but I don't think that's it. We'll be very happy if we can get five.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's my question.
Representative Sean.
Mr. Chair and Commissioners, I'm with Mullery, Representative Mullery here. How many people are quadriplegic in our Department of Corrections custody?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Sean, you know what? I don't have that number offhand, but I can certainly get it for you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to know that. I'd like to know how many times we've actually, the commissioners actually exercised that ability to get these folks released. I mean, that's the questions I'd have. I'd like to know the history on that. I think of the cost, and I think we all know that that's even though you don't track specifically those individuals, I have a hard time believing that anybody who can't use their hands and feet are dangerous to society, and why would we care for them in state custody?
I mean, I know that the Department of Corrections has used nursing facilities, and some in Representative Mullery's district, actually, for some offenders maybe you can get that information for us.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schoen, just one point of clarification. Do you want the total number of conditional medical releases or just those for offenders who are quadriplegic?
Representative Schoen.
I think across the board would be a great thing, and then pinned or itemized by what the condition was.
Sure.
And that would, I think that would be helpful information as well.
Very good.
Mr. Chair, to your point, though, and to this conditional medical release issue, one of the issues that we struggle with is finding housing for our offenders who are medically challenged. I can't find a nursing home that will take one of our guys. There's not a, I mean, one... I have a medical release planner, and I'll get to that later. She called 63 nursing homes for one offender, and nobody will take him. So that's really one of our biggest challenges. If we are going to be releasing somebody who's got a medical issue, who's got, not even a sex offense history, but maybe just a murder history, it's tough to find a place that will take them.
We've got to help
the
human services issue, too.
Representative Cornish.
Mr. Chair and ma'am, my brother's a quad, and he's killed about four deer in the last 6 years. So just because you're quadriplegic doesn't mean you're not dangerous. And we have a sex offender. They're going to put in a nursing home once and released him, and because he was old and didn't think he could be any harm, first thing he did is molest somebody. So we have to be careful who we think can't commit crimes anymore. So.
Okay, so you'll provide that information with us for us. Representative Ward.
Just one more quick thought on this, Mr. Chair, and we've got some state facilities around this state that are sitting empty that could be used for a number of these purposes, and I have been pounding on that for 7 years now, that there are state facilities that would work for this kind of operation, especially for geriatric quad or anybody that, you know, could be in a geriatric facility. So there are buildings available, and I just want to get that on the record, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Ms. Larson, you want to continue with your presentation?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to hepatitis C, you can see the statistics. We estimate 10 to 12% of our population is hepatitis C positive, which is much higher than, of course, in the general community. But there was recently the introduction of a new medication. It's called a protease inhibitor, and please don't ask me what it does because I can't tell you exactly. But it's called a protease inhibitor, which has added to the effectiveness of the traditional pegylated interferon and ribavirin treatment. The addition of that protease inhibitor has increased the cost of treating hepatitis C from $18,000 to $40,000 per offender. And that the adding of that protease inhibitor is now community standard for treating hepatitis, or for treating a certain genotype of hepatitis C. So anyway, so obviously, again, it's one of our drivers of our costs. There are certainly advancements in treating other conditions as well. Bone marrow transplants are becoming more and more frequent to treat certain kinds of cancers. 2 years ago, we had 4 potential bone marrow transplants all at the same time. Some additional drivers of our healthcare costs are obviously our physician and hospital charges. Corizon does a pretty decent job of negotiating discounts for us, or on our behalf, with community providers, but our charges still remain above the Medicare rate. For example, our physician charges are about 198% of Medicare rate, or twice what the Medicare rate is. And for those of you who aren't part of Health and Human Services, Medicaid is the lowest, and then there's Medicare, and then there's what all of the rest of the privates pay. So we're at about 200% of that Medicare rate. Of course, our acuity remains high across the system. We have 12 to 16 dialysis patients at any time. 60 to 65 cancer patients are receiving treatment or palliative hospice care. And then cardiac and cancer care represents our largest costs. The health services budget includes chemical dependency treatment. All offenders are assessed at intake for chemical dependency or abuse issues. About 90% of our offenders are diagnosed as either chemically dependent or abusive. 90%. 80% of them are directed to treatment. We have a capacity of about 860 beds. Treatment is somewhere between 6 to 7 months long. It's not you go in and you come out. It's really mastery-based. Our treatment was developed in tandem with the Department of Corrections and Hazelden. It addresses both the addiction issues, which of course we know Hazelden is great at, as well as the criminal behaviors that we're pretty good at addressing. It's very intensive and it's very long term, so it looks very different than what you would see in the community in terms of length. It's residential in nature and we use therapeutic communities. All of our programs are certified pursuant to statute. They're audited every 3 years by a team of folks from DPS, Public Safety, Human Services, and us. And all of our programs currently have certification. The standards articulate staffing ratios. They articulate hours of programming and, of course, the rules for governing the therapeutic community. Admission to our treatment program is based on high risk, high need. We use the intake assessment, things like whether or not the person is being admitted to us for a DWI offense or not, what is their offense history, what is their LSI score, do they have a sex offense or not. They're placed on a waiting list, and then treatment would occur toward the end of their incarceration. Those who don't get programming or treatment on the inside are directed to treatment on the outside. Unfortunately, we can't treat everybody who is directed to treatment. We just don't have the programming space, nor do we have the beds for that.
So, Ms. Larson, when you say 80% are directed to treatment, who are they directed by?
Mr. Chair, they're directed by the program review team. So that's the team that determines what are their needs for their incarceration. Do they need education? Do they need CD treatment? Do they need sex offender treatment? Do they need a job? Those kinds of things.
And how many of the 80% don't get treatment?
Mr. Chair, we can provide treatment to about 30% of our, to those who are directed to treatment.
And then there's an assumption that post-incarceration they're going to get treatment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We do have release planners in our chemical dependency programs that help to connect the offenders going out with CD treatment in the community.
Thank you.
Again, with respect to sex offender treatment, our offenders are assessed at intake, those who come in with sex offenses. We do have programs at Shakopee for our women. It's an outpatient program. It's not similarly residential like it is with the men. And we do have a sex offender treatment program at Red Wing. The Moose Lake program is a 50-bed program, and it's for those offenders who are most likely to be civilly committed as SDP-SPP. Again, we have to prioritize offenders who go into sex offender treatment, so we prioritize them based on high risk, high need. Again, factors that we consider are length of sentence. It's got to be long enough, but it can't be too long, and it's got to it can't be too short. They all go through an actuarial risk scoring tool. Do they have a CD directive? What is their LSI score? What is the nature of their offense? And then the pattern of their offense history. Treatment includes things like cognitive behavioral therapy, group and individual treatment, education, and risk management. Not all of our offenders who go into, whether it's CD or SO treatment, complete treatment, some of them fail. Some of them don't believe that they need treatment, and obviously that would be a reason for failure. And if they do fail, again, we would direct them to treatment once they get out into the community.
So Ms. Larson, the same question then. Of the 1,962 offenders directed to treatment, what percentage?
About 30%, Mr. Chair, are treated while they're in prison.
So
about 30% of those directed.
30%. So mm-hmm. 70% of sex offenders are not treated.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Yep. Again, all of our... I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Representative Savick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the success rate of treatment? Do you have any idea of people that get treated for sex offenders? What is their success rate that they don't go out and offend again?
Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Savick, I'm sorry, it's not on this slide. For those offenders who complete sex offender treatment, I'm not going to guess. I'm going to get to the right.
Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Grant Dewey. I'm Director of Research with the DOC. To answer your question about the effectiveness of sex offender treatment, we know that offenders who enter treatment, about 60 to 70% either complete or successfully participate until release. And we know that those who do complete treatment, it reduces the risk of sexual recidivism by about 33%.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Can I ask you a question, Mr. Dewey, as long as you're up there? So it reduces recidivism by 30%. Is that what you said, 30%?
33.
By 33%.
Mr. Chair, those who complete. We know that offenders who enter sex offender treatment, it reduces their risk by 27%.
And is your position, do you have oversight over the treatment providers in the facilities, or...
Mr. Chair, I do not.
Providers in the facilities, or...
Mr. Chair, I do not have oversight for those.
Can you tell me what the difference is between the sex offender programs at the Department of Corrections and the MSOP program?
Mr. Chair, I cannot address that, no.
Okay. Do you think we could get that information? I'll tell you why. I think, you know, I keep sort of warning this committee that something's coming down, and something probably is because of that lawsuit against the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. So I really want us to be ready and prepared if there's something that this committee is being asked to do relative to holding more sex offenders in our facility rather than an MSOP. and also given the fact that MSLP seemed to have performed miserably on their treatment, sex offender treatment, at least according to the legislative auditor, I'd like to know what you're doing differently. So maybe you can provide that.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly
get that for you. Okay. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to put you on the spot. I didn't know if you were you're the researcher. Is that what the... I see. Okay. Okay. So we have about 10 minutes left. Do you want to just sort of...
That, Mr. Chair, that's it.
Okay. Can I just ask...
I do it.
I just have one more question. You don't have to provide it to me now, but we sort of glossed over mental health treatment. And it was my fault for not asking, but... You know, one of the things that I've been concerned about, and I've toured a number of facilities, is, and you mentioned it, I think, that that some of the some of these individuals who are in mental health units, do you have statistics like how many of those offenders actually get released directly from a mental health unit out? They've done their sentence without being part of the general population. They're just done.
Mr. Chair, I can certainly get you that number, but I agree with you. Releasing somebody directly from the mental health unit to the streets is not the best option for us, and we try really, really, really hard not to make that happen. We are fortunate that we have a number of units called supportive living services units. They're kind of a step down from our mental health unit, so it still would be for people with chronic mental illnesses but who need a little bit more prodding and more help during the day to get them through their day. And we try to use those SLS units as much as we can as that step down before they go out, but there's sometimes that we can't help but release somebody out of the MHU.
And do we have, can you get us numbers on?
Yep, I certainly can.
And the same question would be for the segregation units. Are they being directly released into the public after their sentence is completed?
And actually, that's a really good segue, Mr. Chair, into my last slide, healthcare release planning. We are fortunate to have a number of healthcare release planners who focus on those offenders with severe mental illness. So those are the ones that we can probably get some numbers for you. With acute or chronic medical conditions, and then those in CD and sex offender treatment. And our release planners actually provide a very comprehensive release plan. So it includes everything from housing to employment to their next appointment in the community with their provider, who their mental health community provider is, their next appointment. We might provide them with durable medical equipment if they need a walker or a wheelchair. We go to Goodwill a lot and get those for them. We ensure that they have some kind of health insurance before they walk out the door, whether it's Medicaid or Medicare. We sign them up with Social Security so that they have some financial aid. And we also work with the families of these offenders to help provide support for them. As I mentioned earlier, their jobs are becoming increasingly more difficult because the housing for our offender population in the community is becoming more difficult. So anyway, with that, that was the last of my slides. Thank you, Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Ms. Larson, for your presentation. Pick up with the Department of Corrections tomorrow. In response to Representative Kelly's question, Mr. Wallace has informed me that the forecast is due out, as you know, on the 28th of February. So we probably won't get our target until sometime in mid-March. Okay, with that, if there's nothing else before the committee, this meeting's adjourned.